This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. The State Fair is one of those signs that summer is underway. And while last year things were different due to the pandemic, now with vaccinations, more things are beginning to open back up, including the State Fair. With us now is Sharon Smith, Director of Communications at the Indiana State Fair. Thank you for joining us today. Sharon, can you take us back to last year? What was it like for the State Fair?
It was an extraordinary experience for our team, who always gets so excited after the end of the previous state fair to start planning for the next state fair. And of course, that didn't happen. We did pivot a bit, and we had an event that allowed us to showcase 4-H youth through livestock competitions and project showcases. So we were able to uplift 4-H in that way, but it wasn't the same. It wasn't the Indiana State Fair. So we are thrilled to be back.
And what were you able to do last year aside from that? Was anything just solely virtual? Did you have any shows virtually, or did everything kind of get put on pause?
Yeah, we did live stream some of the competitions, but many, if not all of the competitions were held in person. And again, it just allowed these kids who had put so much effort into their projects and into their livestock to be able to compete at the state fair level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I can imagine, I mean, a lot of this stuff is outdoors and agriculture, animals, things like that. Do you think that after what you went through last year, did you think that it was possible to make a comeback this year and really come back bigger and better?
Yeah, well, we were all kind of holding our breath to see what would happen with the vaccinations. And certainly that was a breath of fresh air to know that we did have a way to truly combat COVID-19. And we also have kept a close eye on the event industry and watching what other events we're capable of, including the Indianapolis 500 and, of course, other state fairs happening around the country. And we are getting a sense that people are truly excited about gathering again and coming out and enjoying this great family tradition. So definitely the vaccinations help turn a corner for everybody in events.
Yeah, absolutely. And when it comes to sort of the other events that you were keeping an eye on, did any of them stand out that you saw do a really good job and to have a good turnout?
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly, as I mentioned, the Indy 500 was important because it's in our market and they were working closely with the Marion County Public Health Department. We work closely and have worked closely with both the Marion County Public Health Department and the State Department of Health. And of course, the governor's office, and working with all of those public health authorities was very important to us to get a sense of what we were looking at having to do if we had to make any modifications in regards to capacity, et cetera. And to know now that we can move forward July 30th through August 22nd without any capacity limits. It's just encouraging, again, for everyone on our team to know that we can really offer much of what people expect from their Indiana State Fair.
We've spoken with so many different folks on this program with how the pandemic affected businesses or organizations. I'm curious, did you get hit really hard last year in terms of financials? Did that have any effect on what you would be able to plan for this year?
Yeah, we've had to revisit and reforecast our budget many times. We were down 75% in revenue, and it made a significant impact on our planning efforts. But since we've been able to see some revenue come in, we were a host for the NCAA basketball tournament. We've currently been hosting the Fever, the ICHL hockey team that plays here at the Coliseum. The Indy Fuel was successfully able to host their season. So in some ways, we were down in revenue. In other ways, we balanced it out with new activity. So we're going into the fair in a pretty good position. We need it to be successful. We want it to be successful. But we are positioned pretty positively as we're heading into the fair.
That's great to hear. Well, if you're listening and you have any questions or comments for the show, you can always let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Sharon Smith, Director of Communications at the Indiana State Fair, all about this year's State Fair. Sharon, the State Fair is literally around the corner. What has the planning been like? Have you had extra time now since it was off the table last year? Like, is it even easier now to put something together having all that time?
You know, a staff member called it muscle memory. You know, many of us who have been on the team now for a while kind of know what to expect and have a certain cadence leading up to the fair. But that being said, our schedule has been much more compressed than we're used to. And we are just trying to, again, work hard, and we are putting in extra hours to make sure that we make Hoosiers happy and we put on the best show we can. So it's definitely a different schedule this year leading up to the fair, but we're confident that, again, the highlights of what people can expect out of the State Fair will be offered to them.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the events people can expect to see this year?
Yeah, I know people are really excited about the fact that we'll have free concerts every day during the fair. So we have 18 free concerts lined up, a lot of variety on the free stage this year. We've got Indiana's own Babyface coming home to Indiana. We've got Josh Turner, who's a country music artist. We've got a Latina festival this year that's put on by a Latino radio station, which we're very excited about. We've got Casting Crowns. We've got the Beach Boys. So again, these are all free concerts with paid admission. So it's a nice value for folks. We also, of course, have our fair food, and our Taste of the Fair food items were announced last week, and the public has just really engaged on social media, and we appreciate the media coverage because the number one reason people come to the fair is the food, right? Mm-hmm. So 23 new items offered on the Taste of the Fair food competition. Folks can come out and they can try those items, and they can choose their favorite and vote for their favorite item, either using a QR code at each of the booths that are participating or picking up a ballot at our information booth. And then the winner receives $2,500. And second place is $1,000, and third place is $500. So it's a great kind of people's choice competition.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And we've got other new and exciting kind of programming. We've got a new Ferris wheel coming to the grounds at Hoosier Spirit Park, which is over on the north side of the campus. It will be the largest Ferris wheel in the state of Indiana. It's at about 150 feet tall with 36 enclosed gondolas. So it'll allow folks to get a kind of a bird's eye view of the State Fair and probably also be able to get a nice view of downtown Indianapolis. That's $10 per rider. So that's new. We've got a great activation in our Harvest Pavilion. We always look for family-friendly programming in that location. And we're bringing in a program called City of Bricks, featuring Sean Kenny's Wild Connections made with Lego bricks. So these Lego installations are large, and they're nature inspired, and they help teach about the environment. So it's a free, again, exhibit, and that's offered daily throughout the fair. We've got a new lumberjack show, so a Paul Bunyan lumberjack show. So high quality lumberjack skills such as log rolling and axe throwing. That's five times daily, also at Hoosier Spirit Park. We've got a new 5K 1 mile walk run this year called the Deep Fried Dash, and it benefits Daymar and our own Indiana State Fair Foundation. So people can register to run through the fairgrounds and stop at some iconic stops along the way within the fairgrounds. And then at the end, they get some fair food as some treats. So that's new, and that's August the 4th. So much news. We've got, of course, a lot of the staples that people enjoy. The livestock competitions, as I mentioned, the Indiana State Fair Rodeo at the grandstand, the Demolition Derby, Band Day, you know, lots of programming and lots of free items that folks can experience, again, just with paid fair admission.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like there's a lot going on. I'm trying to think which thing I want to go and take part in besides eating funnel cake and corn dogs.
Right. And a lot of this is available at IndianaStateFair.com. We have our program uploaded to our website. So the best thing to do is for people to plan ahead, because it can be overwhelming to come in and figure out, you know, exactly what you think your family would most enjoy. So it's always good to kind of consume that before coming out, and then always feel free to come on back, because we're definitely worth more than a one-day visit.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything like a season pass? Like, can folks come back multiple times, or do they have to pay admission each time they come in?
No, you do have to pay admission every time you come in, but we do have discounts available right now for a family fun pack. So those, again, are all available at IndianaStateFair.com.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to, you know, we can't talk about all this stuff without talking about the fact that we're still in a pandemic. What are there any precautions that are being taken?
Yeah, well, I mean, the safety of our guests and our staff and the entire community is obviously a number one priority for us. But we do ask that folks who are not fully vaccinated definitely follow the guidelines, the CDC guidelines requiring whether and when they should wear a face covering. But for those who are fully vaccinated, including guests, staff, vendors, contractors, you won't need to wear your mask. We're also expanding the fair by an additional weekend on the front end of our schedule. And we did that purposefully because we knew that that's the time when people are most likely to attend, on the weekends. So we wanted to kind of spread out fair attendance a bit more. Of course, most of our programming and activations are outside. We've got a 250-acre campus. But we did want to spread out attendance over the course of another weekend. We are closed Mondays and Tuesdays. That's new this year. And that kind of allows us to refresh programming on those down days, to refresh the campus and prepare for everyone to come back on Wednesday.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for joining us and sharing all of the great new things coming up this year at the State Fair. Sharon Smith, Director of Communications at the Indiana State Fair. After the break, we'll be joined by our team at Indiana Public Broadcasting to get updates on the governor's emergency powers case, as well as get the biggest news in Indiana this past week. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. Or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soeb. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. The last time we checked in with Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter, we learned that Governor Eric Holcomb and Attorney General Todd Rokita were taking their battle over emergency powers to the courts. Since then, there's been some new development. And joining us to give us the latest on that and other topics is Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Thank you so much for joining us. Brandon, let's get caught up on the latest here. Last we heard, there were lawsuits and it wasn't necessarily clear where things were heading. What's the status right now?
Yeah, we've gotten a bit of an update since we last talked. So there are two lawsuits dealing with this emergency powers law, which says that lawmakers can call themselves into a special session of the General Assembly during a public emergency, like during COVID-19. And that law really stemmed a lot from legislators' frustration and in even some cases anger over a lot of the executive orders that Governor Holcomb issued during the pandemic. So this law, though, Governor Holcomb and others believe it's unconstitutional. And so Governor Holcomb filed a lawsuit against the General Assembly to basically just ask the courts to weigh in, to say, hey, I think this is unconstitutional. They think it's constitutional. You need to tell us which of us is correct. There's also a second lawsuit doing the same thing, trying to find out if this law is constitutional or not, but it was from a Hoosier citizen, a guy named John Whitaker, who served in the governor's office like 40 years ago, but otherwise is an attorney here in Indiana. And he, you know, same question. Two different lawsuits. We got an update in both of those cases, actually, in the last few days. First is the governor's lawsuit against the General Assembly. Now, Attorney General Rokita stepped into that one to say, whoa, hold on now. Indiana law says the governor can't sue anybody unless the attorney general gives him permission to do so, because the attorney general's position is that I am the voice of Indiana in court, and therefore, if anybody else tries to be Indiana in court, they can only do so with my permission. That was sort of the first step of that lawsuit, trying to figure out if the governor could even bring this lawsuit in the first place. Well, we got at least an initial answer to that question last week, which is that Attorney General Rokita is wrong and the governor is right, that the governor in this instance, in a case where you're talking about the separation of powers and the governor versus the General Assembly, that in that kind of circumstance, no, the governor does not need the permission of the Attorney General's office. Now, that's not the end of the case, certainly, but at least we got our first answer. And then the other lawsuit, the citizen lawsuit, we got a bit of an answer today about an initial question in that case. Attorney General Rokita, representing lawmakers, said, whoa, this case can't happen right now. It has to happen months from now because the Indiana Constitution prevents lawmakers from being sued while they're in session. And normally they wouldn't be in session right now, but this is a weird year. They have to redraw Indiana's district lines, the redistricting process, and that information they need from the federal government is delayed. And so they are prolonging their session by months, all the way through potentially November of this year. And so they're in session for the vast, vast, vast majority of this calendar year. Well, a county judge said today, no, you can't delay this case because of that. This has nothing to do with that. Let's go forward. So a bit of an update on both fronts.
That's interesting. I was wondering if you could purposely delay and keep the session going just to avoid a lawsuit.
That was brought up in both cases, because the attorney general tried to argue that in both cases, both the governor's lawsuit and the citizen lawsuit. And that was something that the governor's team certainly argued, which is that if you could prevent lawsuits against the General Assembly, they could just keep themselves in session forever. Mm-hmm. And a judge certainly found that compelling as a reason to not allow Attorney General Rokita to delay the lawsuits on those grounds.
Mm-hmm. Now you mentioned Rokita didn't want the governor to sue unless he gave him a permission as the attorney general, and that was it overruled? Like, how would you categorize that? Was a judge the one that made that decision?
Yeah, so a judge. So this was an initial motion, if you will, in the lawsuit, and so a county judge heard arguments over that issue and that issue alone, not the underlying constitutional question here, but that issue alone, and issued a ruling that said, no, Attorney General Rokita is dead wrong. He kind of took apart every argument that Attorney General Rokita and his office have made and said, no, this case, you know, can go forward. The governor has a right to sue. Again, that's not the end of the process, because Attorney General Rokita is asking permission to appeal that ruling. Now, This gets really kind of in the weeds, but I'll just say that unlike the normal appellate process that we often hear about, in this particular one, the judge who gave this initial ruling can decline the offer or the request to appeal entirely. So we will see how that plays out, hopefully here pretty soon, and when we get to the arguments over this underlying question.
Mm-hmm. Now, are we getting into never before seen territory yet for Indiana lawmakers with these cases, or is this pretty standard?
No, this is incredibly unusual. It's incredibly rare for the governor to sue the General Assembly at all in any way, shape, or form, and for sort of these intergovernmental battles to play out in court. That's not completely unheard of. We've seen intergovernmental battles in Indiana before, but it's very rare. And this particular case, where the governor is alleging that the General Assembly is trying to take one of his constitutional powers away from him for themselves, that has, at least so far in this initial judge's ruling, he called it a case of first impression, which in legal terms means we've never seen this before. We are making new ground here as far as the courts are concerned. So it's incredibly rare to even see this sort of battle play out. And on this particular kind of case, this is a first for Indiana.
So it's setting a new precedent, I guess.
Absolutely. In multiple ways, as it turns out.
Yeah. Well, when it comes to taxpayers, how are they involved in these cases going forward? Is their money being used to support either side?
Yeah, absolutely it is. So the governor or the attorney general's office is doing all of this work on these cases with the, you know, with the funds in his office. So it's not like they're requesting new or extra money to do this. It's within the funds of his department, but that's money that's not being used on anything else in his office. And generally how taxpayers feel about that, if they like what Attorney General Rokita is arguing for, that they like this law, that they don't want the governor to succeed, well, then they're fine with him spending those funds to fight this case. If they don't like the attorney general's office, if they don't like what he's advocating for, or if they don't like this law in the first place that the General Assembly passed, well, then they're upset about the taxpayer dollars being used to fight these lawsuits. But that's often true in a lot of different cases. We hear the same sort of arguments with the anti-abortion laws and the lawsuits that come out of them that Indiana gets involved in just about every year. And it's the sort of the same thing. If you like those anti-abortion laws, then you're happy to spend state dollars to fight for them. If you don't like those laws, then you're upset the taxpayer dollars are going to their defense.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you have any questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Brennan, let's talk about the abortion reversal bill that was blocked by a federal judge. For those who haven't been following, what was going on before the judge got involved?
Sure. Well, this law is one of many that Indiana has passed over the last decade that tries to curtail abortion rights in some way, shape, or form, because Indiana's Republican supermajorities are very opposed to abortion. So what the latest law did was promote a procedure called abortion reversal. And it's a theory that says in a medication abortion, now a medication abortion requires taking two pills at different times. And what abortion reversal purports is that if you don't take the second pill and then potentially take another medication instead, you can stop or reverse the abortion from taking place. The problem is that leading medical organizations call that unproven and unethical because there have been no valid scientific studies that have proven that abortion reversal is safe and effective. The lawsuit that came out of that came after the passage of this law is that the law was telling every doctor in the state of Indiana that they had to tell their patients about abortion reversal, that it could potentially stop or reverse an abortion. And a federal judge, as you mentioned, blocked that law from taking effect before it was set to take effect on July 1st. And the reasoning that the judge gave was, you can't put words into someone, the state cannot put words into someone's mouth unless they are true and proven. And the best evidence that we have as a scientific community at this point is that it's not yet proven scientifically to be safe and effective.
Right. And is there any argument that, you know, the government shouldn't be getting involved in people's personal health?
Oh, sure. There are lots of arguments about that. But that, I mean, that goes well beyond this single anti-abortion case.
Right.
That goes to the heart of a lot of the anti-abortion laws that Indiana has passed over, like I said, the last decade plus. And although I will note that this is the ninth time that a lawsuit has been brought in the last decade over a newly passed anti-abortion law in Indiana. And as of this new one, those laws, the state has lost, at least initially, in all nine of them.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us this afternoon and sharing all of this information. It's always good to catch up with you. Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. We're now going to switch over and join Lauren Chapman, digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting, to get some updates on some of the stories of the past week. Lauren, thank you so much for joining us. Let's talk about the iLearn standardized testing and the latest on what's happening there.
Yeah, so iLearn testing results are expected, I believe, Wednesday. And that, of course, is the standardized testing that Indiana launched to replace iStep. one thing to keep in mind, because last year was an extraordinary year, was that lawmakers passed legislation called Hold Harmless, so that the results did not negatively impact teacher evaluations or school ratings, in recognition that last year was a pandemic and learning was hard for everyone. So there's a lot of anticipation for what the results will be. The State Department of Education anticipates that the results aren't going to be great. They anticipate that, you know, they will be indicative of learning loss. There's a lot of debate and question about how valuable that data is going to be overall.
Mm-hmm. Well, were folks able to opt out of iLearn if they didn't want to go and take the test in person, for example?
Yeah, so the Indiana Department of Health applied for, very similar to a lot of states in the country, applied for a federal waiver for participation and accountability from standardized testing. But as of May, more than 80% of students had already taken iLearn. The department said in at the end of May that somewhere around 97% of students participated in iLearn. So a lot of students did end up participating, but didn't have to if parents had concerns about sending their kids in for in-person testing, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. That's a pretty big number of people to come together and take the testing, even though it seems like there are some rumblings of folks who aren't really for that.
Yeah, I mean, there the one thing to keep in mind, especially with Indiana schools, is that the Department of Health throughout somewhere around 99% of schools had some length of in-person learning throughout the pandemic or throughout the pandemic last year, mm-hmm. And in the spring. So a lot of students were in class, were in person, were on some sort of version of schedule that allowed them to be in person already to take tests. So there was probably less of students being out of class for standardized testing.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been keeping an eye on these different COVID-19 variants, and lately everyone's been talking about the Delta variant, although I do think there have been some newer ones popping up. Are we not seeing any movement on the state level to bring back restrictions as we hear more troubling news about how contagious these variants are?
Yeah. So last Friday, Indiana health officials had a press conference and basically said they're not planning any more statewide COVID-19 restrictions, even as they were sounding the alarm about the Delta variant. Since the end of June, we've seen a 54.5% increase in the number of Delta variant cases that we are testing for, in the very small sample size of cases that Indiana is doing genetic testing on. Comparing that to one of the older variants, like the Alpha variant, we've only seen a 7.5% increase. So this is an alarming jump. The state health commissioner on Friday basically said, look, the state's not planning any new or renewed statewide restrictions, but pointed back to individual communities and schools in consultation with their local public health officers may decide to add restrictions, which, because of legislation passed during Indiana's General Assembly, is a little bit more limited than it was just a year ago.
Mm-hmm. So some people may be bringing back, let's say, mandating some masks for their businesses?
Yeah, I mean, the businesses are well within their rights to do so. So far, I haven't heard of any communities that are moving in that direction. I know Marion County in Indianapolis hadn't made any movement about rolling back some of those restrictions or anything along those lines. And it also comes down to the kind of vaccine population that we have, right? We hear a lot about the Delta variant and how it's, you know, decimating, you know, communities that are unvaccinated. And when we look at places like Missouri, for example, we line up pretty closely with them. And so the state health officials that were talking on Friday were like, go get vaccinated, because that's our best defense against the Delta variant is making sure that you're vaccinated.
Right, absolutely. Well, we have about a minute left. Do you think you can give us a quick run through about the Federal Election Reform Bill?
Yes, I can. It's called the For the People Act. It does a bunch of stuff, including making Election Day a federal holiday, automatic voter registration, restricts voter roll purges, which is a big deal in Indiana, expands vote by mail, voter verified paper ballots to improve election security. And last week, a number of election focus groups led by Common Cause Indiana and several others came together to put pressure on Senators Young and Braun to support the For the People Act. Whether or not that happens is kind of neither here nor there, but there's a lot of, they're making a lot of noise about a federal election bill that may end up being really important.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Lauren Chapman, digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Coming up, inclusive theater for kids. Will this pave the way for the future of arts? We'll find out. If you have any questions or comments, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. When it comes to theater, there have been more conversations lately about equity and inclusion, and one theater group out of Bloomington has been doing more than just talking about it, even in the midst of the pandemic. We're going to learn more about the group and how everything got started. But first, if you have any questions or comments, you can reach out to us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. With us now, we have Marcus Simmons, music and theater faculty at Bethel University, as well as music supervisor for the Bloomington Citywide Youth Theater Collective, and Liam Kuntz, one of the members of the Citywide Youth Theater Collective. Welcome to you both. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Marcus, let's start from the beginning. How did this theater group get started?
The beginning is a very good place to start. I think the accurate place to pin as the beginning is a conversation Dr. Gus Waltzek and I had about if we could redo how theater with youth is approached from an educational perspective, what would we do? And we realized in our own training that has been most impactful is that you study all of the different angles and sides of theater, but you kind of wait until you become quote unquote serious about it in college. And we thought, well, what if we actually could give students a way to enter the work from that more inclusive perspective, kind of as the makers and the doers, instead of just as actors, or in some cases they feel more like pawns. And so we came up with this idea of a collaborative collective, kind of like you see in a lot of large cities across the country, where there's an improvisatory theater and an improv, you as the troupe are creating the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just going to say, I came across an article about your theater group, and I was really, really intrigued because it just sounds so cool to be able to start something from a younger group of folks and kind of build them up with the skills that they need. And so what is your involvement so far with the theater group? What is your role?
So my role is music supervisors. Specifically, I am involved with resourcing the students, and that I think language is important. I am, yes, trying to provide some sort of instruction, but I also recognize that in many ways they already come with some resources, some ideas, some skills, and then some of it is just talent that needs refining. And so I see the workshops and things that I did as a means of providing opportunity for that, instead of assuming that they know nothing and teaching them everything, because I think when we do that, we negate part of their sort of innate humanity.
Mm-hmm. Well, Liam,
and
what
then
made...
From there, it's just been a lot of technical stuff once we got into post-production.
Yeah, yeah. And I know Liam's part of the collective, and I'm curious, Liam, yes. What made you decide to be part of this theater collective?
Well, so it was actually my dad. So he was like part of it. And he asked me, he was like, we need musicians. And I play the violin and piano. So I was like, okay, well, I'll think about it. And then I ended up doing it. And I guess I accidentally gave myself like one of the lead roles. So I kind of... So I did both. I made some songs and I also was in the performance.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you accidentally give yourself a lead role? I'd like to know so I can get a lead role somewhere.
So when we were like when it was like just starting out and we didn't really have anything, we were supposed to like write a story, or not really a story, but an experience you had with like racism or something like that. Mm-hmm. And they decided that my story was a good, like, backbone, I guess. And that just put me in the place to play the character I was playing, named Aaron Martinez. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So were you playing, like, a character based off of your own story?
Kind of. It was a bit of a self-insert. Oops. But mm-hmm. I think I'm happy with how it came out, and I think that it did the things that we wanted it to do.
Cool. And Marcus, when it comes to this group and the different productions that they're doing, you mentioned that, you know, the kids involved are putting these things together and they're bringing their skills about. Is this unique to theater? I mean, is it generally that people are just told what to do and memorize lines?
Essentially, yes. It's pretty rare that we ask the actors to come up with the story that they're going to act and the characters that they're going to inhabit. Generally, it's someone else does all of that work and has a story and sets a world. And then we try to work our way into inhabiting it and create something that feels real on stage. So by taking this approach where we actually ask the actors to make the world and to write the script and to create the characters, they're able to bring a reality to it that is much, I think, deeper and more profound in many ways, because there isn't the disconnect or the imposition of our own experience on someone else's creation. The creation and the creator are one and the same.
Mm-hmm. I like that you said not putting your own experience on somebody else. Do you feel that these types of projects not only give people a voice, but allow themselves to be seen in productions that maybe otherwise they wouldn't get a chance to?
That's the hope. When we approached doing this work, we wanted to provide a platform for the youth to tell us their stories and to help us to see into their world. You know, generally with theater, we're thinking, oh, I look at this character, I can understand someone else's experience. Well, what if the experience you're understanding is actually the experience of the person that you're looking at? And especially with youth, we tend to think, oh, well, they don't know anything. They're wet behind the ears with baby's breath. But actually, this production for me proved my supposition that they actually do indeed have a story to tell already. The group was that we gathered are 13 to 18 year olds. And by the time you're 18, we kind of assume, oh, you can drink and rather drive and smoke cigarettes. And there's walking and talking and things that you do, but you can't drink yet. And you still have some growing to do. But at 13, we're like, you're still a kid. What do you mean? You mm-hmm. just barely got out of diapers. But this collective really, I think, showed us that no matter what the age, there was quite a bit of life or quite a bit of experience, even some wisdom that is already living in the youth, and their voices are incredibly important. So I do think that your point about this being a unique and sort of special space is accurate.
And Liam, what was your experience like? I mean, did you feel like it was great to have so much say in this creative process?
Yeah, well, it was fun, and I really liked working with the other members of the collective. And I think that the the whole like project itself did a really good job at like letting everybody just have like their own thing. Like nothing was really off limits and anybody could suggest anything and there wouldn't be like, I don't know, there wasn't like an expectation to be like right or wrong. It was just kind of like, what do you think would work best?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like there was some improv involved.
Yeah, there was. We did some like, we did some stuff with that, yeah.
And like, what was your favorite part in this process?
Probably the like beginning of it where we were like getting to know each other and stuff. And we would, like I said, we were doing like improv exercises and we'd also do like games, like name games and stuff like that. And I thought that was really fun.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, I love improv and I love icebreaker games. I know some people think that they're cheesy, but I love it. So
yeah,
it's a great way to get to know people. Yeah. Marcus, I know that my understanding is that part of also putting this collective together was to highlight Black, Indigenous and people of color, as well as LGBTQ folks. Why was it such an important message to put this out there?
I think that oftentimes those groups lack legibility in our society on a day-to-day basis, as well as from a macro cultural perspective. And so instead of continuing the practice of trying to tell those stories from other people's perspective, we wanted to allow people in those groups that sound self-identify in those groups to speak their truth and tell their story. And then the way we got to that as a focus was, we said, okay, well, we want to tell real stories and we want to tell specific stories to the youth that live here in the state of Indiana. And so we wanted to make sure that we gathered a group that represented the youth in the state of Indiana. The focus on giving voice to the often voiceless or marginalized persons was a little bit of a passion of mine as a person who is also frequently marginalized, but also it seemed to be appropriate given the struggles of the day. As I have worked with youth and Dr. Welczek has worked with youth, we're often surprised, maybe is the right word, with how much they grapple with on a day-to-day basis, how much navigating they're doing and the space that they feel they have or do not have. And so the idea of youth as a whole being a marginalized group and then providing even further nuance into that was of great interest to me. And I think became great interest to us. And so then, of course, that nuance becomes highlighting LGBTQ folks and the Black, Indigenous, people of color population. And just making sure that we create as broad and deep a space as possible so that there's legitimacy and legibility for as many people as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's amazing what you're doing. And I'm curious, is it hard for youth to open up on topics and perform and let go? Or are they more likely to be open versus an adult?
So I think that it depends. I won't say that youth are a monolith, but I think that we were very fortunate with the group that we were able to assemble. We first, of course, had to establish trust. And I think that's the piece that is somewhat ephemeral, but also foundational and fundamental that many miss in education, in the arts. With youth and children especially, there's that impulse to just impose and tell them, I know and you do not. And so come sit at my feet and gather these pearls that I'm going to drop and bestow on you. We didn't approach this project that way, and I don't tend to approach my work that way either. I think it's really important for them to understand that they are people and in many ways just as much have just as much to teach me as I have to teach them. So we were lucky, as I said, that this group opened up, and especially I think we were able to achieve that with what Liam described as his favorite part of the process, which hearing that for me is really exciting and validating, because we really struggled as a group of adults to find a way to make space and to bring the youth into the work in a way that did exactly what it seems that it did. So I'm curious actually what Liam would have to say to the question about whether he thinks what we did was unique or if he feels like his peers tend to be open and honest with one another more than adults.
Yeah, Liam, let us know.
Well, I think that like, it really just depends. Like Marcus said, like, I think that it was easier for us to get comfortable and start trusting each other because we were all like younger. And that maybe like adults, like, okay, I don't know what adults are thinking, but, I can't really say that it's like this whole project was definitely unique. And I liked it and I enjoyed it as my first experience in theater actually. But, I don't know if like the difference between like younger people getting to know each other and getting comfortable with each other is like that much different than adults doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know if either group has an easier time. I think it just depends on if the person is willing to.
Right. You know? Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm thinking back like with improv and things like that. I used to do improv, so that's why I'm bringing this up. It's harder for adults in some aspects because they're like, you got to act like a kid again, you know, just let go, let loose, and you're just always in your head. And so I wonder for younger adults and youth, you're more carefree in some instances, maybe, to be able to just play around.
Yeah. Yeah, and I also, like, it really just depends on the person, though. Like, a lot of people are reserved. Mm-hmm. Like I would say that I'm more reserved than I am like outgoing, I guess. But it also just, yeah, it just really depends on like who you're working with.
Yeah, yeah. No, I can see
would
that.
I would agree with your assessment of yourself, Liam, and I think you're right. We were able to help you to feel safe to sort of to be and exist and kind of show up in the space. And so, but I think also that there might be a point that because you guys are closer to quote unquote child years, it's, you're able to be a little bit more of yourself. And then that self is a little bit more like the quote unquote childlike approach that we tend to use in improv. So thank you for sharing that, Liam.
Yeah, of course.
Well, we're about ready to wrap up. Marcus, is there anything else coming up for the theater group that we can keep an eye on?
Well, I'll just take this moment to say we are we're interested in continuing doing this work. And so because we rely on grant funding to do so at the moment, we are looking for any opportunities to continue to fund this work because clearly you see it's made an impact on youth, and we just think that it increasing or continuing that is important. We also are going to be doing a public presentation. We're looking at the fall. At the moment, we did a sneak preview to kind of show the students where the post-production process is and how it's gone, and to continue to keep them involved in the work so it's not, we don't cut them out at any point. So that if you're interested in seeing this and following this, continue to keep your ears and eyes open, looking to the fall.
All right. Well, thank you both so much for joining us. Marcus Simmons, Music and Theater Faculty at Bethel University and the Music Supervisor for the Bloomington Citywide Youth Theater Collective, and Liam Kuntz, one of the members of the Citywide Youth Theater Collective. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. I'm Miriam Soeb. Thanks for listening. This is All In.